When you need to work quickly and confidently, you need Grammarly. It's a trusted AI writing partner that helps you get work done faster with better writing. And it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Get AI writing support that works where you work. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Create the deck of your dreams now at Menards. Spend less time maintaining your deck and more time enjoying it. With UltraDeck low-maintenance composite decking from Menards. It's easy to install and built to last. Plus, get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on UltraDeck. And check out more great deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. Any discussion about American music that doesn't include Muscle Shoals, Alabama isn't really a discussion at all. That's a direct quote from the website of Fame Studios. We had a chance to visit Muscle Shoals and the two studios that stayed undercover for most of the 60s and 70s while legends came to record with a producer and a rhythm section that should be household names. Join us at the table as we discuss the music of Muscle Shoals. Welcome to the Steel Magnolias Podcast. We are two sisters here to have uplifting conversations about life in the South.
The South is full of beautiful diversity in landscape, people groups, and culture, and we want to showcase each part. We've got plenty of room at our table, so pull up your chair.
Welcome back to the table. I am Laura Beth.
And I'm Lainey.
And we are here to discuss
one of our favorite things, music.
Music. And this really, sorry for the pun, struck a chord with me. I didn't even realize how much I was going to enjoy visiting Muscle Shoals until I actually went.
Yeah, when I saw that documentary that came out in 2013 about Muscle Shoals, I was floored.
Yeah.
How all of that had happened. And I was just hearing about it.
Yeah.
Really floored me. I mean, I knew there was recording studios down there. I knew there had been some renown, but not to the extent and influence that
I think I knew, but I think I thought it was probably less legendary moments than I was giving it credit for. Or I had to have known that, or else I would have gotten down there sooner. I know this has been a topic on your list for a really long time. Was this one of your original topics, do you think?
Maybe. I don't know if it was on the original list that I made before we even started. But
also wanted to mention to you guys that on a programming note, we'll be starting our summer break after this episode. So you can go back and listen to old episodes and
get caught up. And we're also going to do a fun giveaway soon. So
yes, if you haven't started following us on Instagram or Facebook,
why haven't you?
Now's the time. Well, let's talk proximity. So obviously we are in Franklin, Tennessee, just south of Nashville. Muscle Shoals is in the northwest corner of the state of Alabama, almost on the Tennessee-Alabama state line, like really close, probably like one county in between us in Alabama. And Muscle Shoals has a population of right at 17,000. So small.
It's small.
Small. It's on the Tennessee River, which
it's right next to Florence, Alabama, where the University of Northern Alabama is located.
Yeah. If you are, I would say, a huge Lynyrd Skynyrd fan, you may have caught the name Muscle Shoals lyrics before. But you may have never, ever, ever heard of this place, and that is okay. We're going to tell you all about it today. And I believe if you love music, you're going to want to pack your bags and get down here. Like, I promise, actually, that you will want to do that.
It's epic.
So you mentioned the documentary. So the documentary is called Muscle Shoals and came out in 2013. If you're wanting to watch it, it's on Amazon Prime, I know, right now, and other streaming services, I'm sure. And if you do go, watch the documentary before you go. Both tours that we took, the opening statement was,
who's seen the documentary?
Yeah, or question, I guess.
And
I
they don't give you all of that background because they assume you may have seen it.
Yeah.
Because it's been out for 10 years, so.
Yes.
These are small studios too. So there's not, don't imagine a room where they're going to open you up to start with like a video that a lot of museums and sort of visual arts places do.
It's too small.
So definitely watch the documentary before you go. It is so good, and it's chock full of the timeline and all the information. And it has a lot of key people that are no longer with us.
I know.
So thank you, filmmakers that got that.
But isn't that important?
Captured, yes.
I mean, even what we do, we're seeing that sometimes people pass away that we've interviewed, and you're just so grateful it's documented.
Yeah. The documentary follows the story of famed studio founder Rick Hall and the very, very, very difficult upbringing that he had. I'll give you a very quick snippet. His brother died tragically at age 3. His parents split from that tragedy in 1961. His pretty new wife was killed in a car accident that
he was the driver
in the accident. She ended up dying. His father died within 2 weeks of that tragedy. So
very, 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 very poor.
Yes.
Like that plays into his story.
And yes. White guy. Let me go ahead and say that, because that's going to play into some interesting pieces of Rick's story later. But yes, very difficult upbringing. The interesting part of the documentary is that I didn't realize, you know, a lot of this was news to me when I was watching it. I didn't realize that that was like news to the community, that this stuff was happening in their backyard.
That's hilarious, right? That you find out later that Mick Jagger was in your backyard, practically. Yeah.
And she's not kidding. The Rolling Stones, Lynyrd Skynyrd. And on and on.
So, Bob Seger, Paul Simon. I mean, major acts.
Yeah, major acts. So Rodney Hall, Rick's son, now runs and is sort of the face of Fame Studios because Rick has since passed away. And I read that he actually said about the documentary that they were basically forced to start giving tours at Fame Studios because people just started showing up.
Like, I've got to
see this. We want to see this place because they saw the documentary. And then, So then during that same time period, so it came out in 2013, in that same time period, Rodney actually spearheaded a way to raise funds and start a nonprofit, the Muscle Shoals Music Foundation, which brought the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio back and opened it back up as a tourism destination. And they also have the nearby Alabama Music Hall of Fame. So now it really is a place where if you're wanting to kind of spend the day or make a trip out of it, it feels like this is a destination.
There's some things to see.
Yes. Yeah. And that's really important in tourism. I never really knew that before sort of doing some of this work that we do now, that you can't just have like
one, you know, random out of in the middle of nowhere place.
Yes.
It's got to be several
things.
You have
to build some things around it.
There's also nearby the W.C. Handy.
Okay.
Home and Museum, where he's considered by some the birthplace of it's the birthplace of the father of the blues.
Yes.
There's different people they say is the father of the blues, but he's one. So if you're into blues,
yes,
that might be another thing you could tack on.
W.C. Handy is a name you heard on our Dockery Farms episode when we went and toured that place in Mississippi where the blues was started as well. So we might need to be linking to some different
episodes. That's true.
As part of this. Well, FAME stood for Florence, Alabama Music Enterprise, and they just shortened it to FAME. So the sign above the studio is just something that Rick came up with, and it says, "Through these doors walk the finest musicians, songwriters, artists, and producers in the world." And that is almost the understatement of the year for 1961
right?
and beyond. Like, it's just crazy. So, yeah, you mentioned there are names like, and I'm talking about just FAME right now, Etta James, Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, Alicia Keys, Demi Lovato, Jason Isbell. They've all come now to this tiny little studio. There's two recording studios within the building itself. And they're looking for that soulful sound. And they've heard about it now. Word is out. And they
want to replicate it. So let's talk about how did he do it?
Yeah. It's one of the longest continually running studios in the world.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's important, too.
Yes. That's still, like, originally owned by the same group. Because it's still in the family.
Yeah. And it's listed alongside Sun, Stax, Motown, and Abbey Road as the most important recording studios in history.
Wow.
And I just like throwing things like this in. That's five different studios, three of them in the South.
We have endless content on this show is there's so much good that comes out of this region of the U.S.
No, we just got the soul going on.
Okay, so how did Rick Hall do it? Like, why Muscle Shoals? Why? What was the sort of perfect storm that came about? Well,
it depends on who you ask, discuss. I'm sure. But let's say, I think part of it, we got to sit down with his wife, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. And she was just saying he was always so driven.
Yes.
Driven to excellence, pushed others to excellence.
Came from nothing and had a lot to prove.
A lot to prove.
Yes.
I think that's part of it.
Yes.
I think he was a wise, he was a musician himself, knew what sound he was looking for.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it.
And not just driven, but savvy enough to teach himself things. The only reason that he knew anything about engineering is because his band, like you said, he was musical. He was in a band that would play at the radio station. And so he got to know kind of the soundboard and different elements of creating music via the radio station. So he's completely self-taught.
I love stuff like this.
I mean, I'm self-taught on the podcast, so I have a little appreciation. But when I saw all those soundboards and different tracks and things, that's pretty wild to see somebody that was able to figure all that out. So, yeah. So, he had nothing that he came from, had a lot to prove, was very driven, very entrepreneurial, and musically savvy himself. And he met a guy that was named Arthur Alexander, local kid that had a song titled You Better Move On, and he decided to record it. And it sounded good. And he had musicians that he was able to bring in to play with Arthur Alexander because, like I said, he was in a band.
Right.
So, like, this is true to any small town. The musicians know each other. Like you,
that's so true.
You gig together and you play on porches together.
You pull this drummer in and you pull this banjo in if you need it. And yeah.
So again, Arthur Alexander comes up with this song, You Better Move On, and it became a hit and it gave Rick enough money to then go build a proper studio. And so he built out this amazing rhythm section, and they worked hard and Rick trained them, and they were session players. But what you noticed was an observation that you made, and they were not just musicians.
Right.
So you can find musicians and you can bring them in from other places even.
And this was four guys that went to high school there. They were friends. They were, you know, just not only good musicians, I think they had a groove because they were friends. Mm-hmm. And I think they were all four really creative.
Yes.
Themselves. They weren't just able to do, you know, like read music and play it. They had their own creative style.
Yes.
And I think that was hugely important with what the future would hold.
Yes. They were also white.
Yes.
And
there's a reason we're saying this. It matters.
Yes. And Arthur Alexander, the first hit is black. Jimmy Hughes, the second hit with Steal Away, was black. And so there was an interesting way that two races in northern Alabama were coming together and creating amazing music.
But the cool thing is they didn't see any problem. I mean, it was just like they didn't seem to really think about it.
Which is miraculous when the governor's over there shouting,
right,
segregation forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not kidding. Like, that was literally the speeches that were being given at that same time. So it's even in the 60s, it's who you know, right? Through different people, Rick met a guy named Jerry Wexler, who ran Atlantic Records. Now, that's
I think
all...
we heard they met at a party in Atlanta or something.
Yeah, Jerry lived up in New York, and from what I saw in the documentary, like very New York.
Very New Yorker.
Yeah, the accent, the demeanor, all of it, right? So Jerry is open to hearing from Rick, says to him, if you've got something sometime, give me a call. And so he does. Tells him he's got a hit. Jerry comes to Muscle Shoals to see what Rick is up to. They begin to work together. I think Jerry thought also what we just described with
these rhythm players are, these rhythm players are awesome.
And they were awesome. Yes. Yes. This is not what he was seeing up in New York.
These guys, they are coming up with creative content themselves.
Yes.
From listening to a demo.
Yes. So enter Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin had been with Columbia and had been more of like trying to make it as a pop star and was getting nowhere. I think she was on their label for about 4 years. And so then they dropped her because having any success. As soon as she was dropped, Jerry's calling Aretha. I don't know. I didn't hear much about like what he really saw in her or why he was sparked with her, but he brought her down to Muscle Shoals. And again, I can't stress enough, she had not had hits yet. It's like we hear Aretha Franklin and we're like, hello, like, Aretha's coming.
Right.
That was not...
She's an unknown.
...what was happening. In fact, these guys were like teenagers that were in the rhythm section. And I thought it was interesting. I watched an additional interview with them that I'll link to in our show notes because it was really fun to watch. It was the Music Hall of Fame talking to the three rhythm section players that we heard the most from.
Okay.
And only two of them are still, only one of them is living. And so, they were like, she seemed nervous. Like, wow. We were nervous, you know, because we were always nervous, right? Because we knew if we weren't good, we could get fired.
Wow. Yeah.
So, but they, you know, kind of were talking about how she seemed sort of nervous. But while working down in Muscle Shoals, she seemed to find a little bit of her sound. I kind of think it was probably some gospel roots that maybe tapped back into from church singing days. I don't know.
Which is where she learned everything, I'm sure.
Yeah. So she spent some time there and they recorded some. Unfortunately, while doing some recording there, there was some sort of argument, you know, men and pride and who knows what was in the room. But her then husband was very frustrated and argument basically ended in Rick, the founder of Fame, and Jerry Wexler's of Atlantic, their relationship really severed after this whole blow up around Aretha and her then husband. If you've watched the movie with Jennifer Hudson, you know, like that was a volatile and difficult situation that it almost seemed when we were hearing that story of what happened at Fame, I was like, that probably
I can totally
didn't
see
take
this
much.
Go down.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but lucky for the rest of us that her first cut at Fame was the million-selling double-sided smash hit I Never Loved a Man and Do Right Woman. This album won a Grammy for Album of the Year, and then Fame also was the publisher on Do Right Woman, which you'll hear later from Linda Hall, Rick's wife, that's important for legacy and for...
That's right. Publishing's where it's at to keep it going.
Dolly Parton will tell you that up and down. Okay, so it ended with a relationship severed, but there was some great music that came, and Aretha then is now on a trajectory of success.
Upward.
She's now Aretha, right? She's not just Aretha Franklin, now she's just Aretha, right? So the guys from the rhythm section, they decided it's 1969, they've been doing this almost 10 years, they're ready to do some producing on their own, they're ready to be out on their own. And they decide that they're going to branch out. We will hear again from Linda Hall how devastating that was for Rick when the rhythm players came to him and said, hey, we're going to go do our own thing. He had built a lot on them. But you know, I really feel like those two parties, if you say the Rick Hall and then the Swampers is what a lot of people know them as now. But they
at that point in time were just called the, what was it? The Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section.
Rhythm Section, yes. Both of those were needed for, I think, what we're talking about. Not one, not the other. They were both, it was team. It was so team, in my opinion. And so they decide to branch out. Rick is heartbroken. And it's just unbelievable, really, that Fame even was able to come back and
bounce back,
build more players. I would like to give credit to artists that they produced even after the fact, after moments I've described. They went on to record Otis Redding, Etta James, Wilson Pickett, Little Richard. Dwayne Allman was a session player at Studio B. It's Dwayne Allman of the Allman Brothers. And
before it was the Allman Brothers.
He just the story goes that he just desperately wanted to be a part of Fame. And he apparently, camped out?
Popped a tent in the parking lot and kept asking to be a player.
Yes. And so you could go as far as saying that the Allman Brothers, because they really were doing a tryout in Studio B at Fame, you could probably say that that's where their band formed.
Probably.
Almost. So they are still a functioning and producing studio today, which I think is so interesting. Everything is stopped in time. You walk in, you're seeing
that's so true.
You're seeing green carpet, you're seeing a lot of wood paneling, you're seeing retro everything, right? The tours that they have available are broken up into what they call a backstage tour, which you get to go upstairs, you get to see Rick Hall's office, you get to see a piano that Aretha played on that's up there. I mean, there's so much memorabilia up there. It's small, but it's, you know, probably two or three rooms, I guess.
I think we went in three separate rooms up there.
Yeah, so that's a kind of add-on if you want, and I thought that was really cool. And then you also, as your just standard tour ticket, you get to see both
the two studios,
Studio A and B, and the little break room. So, and it, like I said, it's small. So, you know, you're just kind of standing around in each of those rooms talking for a while. But there's so much to cover.
Yeah. And you mentioned that there's even modern acts that have recorded there. Alicia Keys, Raconteurs, Demi Lovato.
Yeah, we even heard that Steven Tyler's come by before. Did you say him already? Sorry.
I did not.
And
then Warren Treaty.
Yeah.
Or they had just been there.
Yeah. Jason Isbell's still doing some recording there.
So, yeah, they're still getting the acts now.
Yeah.
Even after Rick Hall has passed away in 2018.
Yeah.
So. And if you watch the documentary or have heard stories about Rick Hall, he was known as a very difficult guy.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult to work with, difficult to be married to, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time. But he was very driven to excellence and expected that of everybody around him. Mm-hmm. And so I think that played into his personality, but also, you know, what happened there in the Fame Studios.
Agree. So let's talk about this rhythm section we've been mentioning. We had Jimmy Johnson on guitar, Roger Hawkins on drums, and David Hood on bass. David is the only one that is still living today.
There was four, though.
And there's, Barry Beckett on keys.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those were the four players. They equally owned and operated the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio. They picked this little just small building on Jackson Highway, and it was for rent, and they discussed it among themselves, and so with, you know, much back and forth, they did decide to buy it.
It's a two-story building. They had the recording studio upstairs, the, what do we call it, the lounge?
The basement lounge.
Downstairs.
Yeah.
Which has some fascinating stories to it as well, because, well, both studios that we toured had this. It's a dry county.
Yes.
It was a dry county. So they had to have kind of a secret area where the musicians could partake of adult beverages.
Yes. Yeah. And it is secret. Like, he kind of banged on the, or like kind of
paneling to make a door
open. Punched the wall to,
pop it open.
Was exactly what I would picture it would be. And it like looks so 70s with the paneling, with the lamps and the low couch and ashtrays sitting around. I could see all of these musicians hanging out in there.
Yeah.
When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context. Plus, tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Get more at Andy Moore Ford. Drive home with 0% APR financing for 72 months and save $18,000 off MSRP on a new 2023 Ford Mustang Mach-E. Get more for your money at Andy Moore Ford.
Stock number 38449, MSRP 66,035. Includes 18,000 dealer discount, 72 monthly payments of $13,894,000 borrowed. Honda pre-credit, tax title license fee, and 237.51 DAC excluded. Expires 7/8/2024.
And this would be a good time to mention that this building took a lot of restoration because the original building, it was abandoned in the late 90s. So it had from late 90s to 2013 to sit there and get really
yucky.
And
they had to make it look back like it had been in the 70s.
Yeah, because I think it had been maybe a couple of retail shops after it had been the studio. Anyway, okay, so let's talk about these guys. They've had a little experience, you know. They've offered Aretha her success. So they get their first client, who is Cher. Hello, Cher. Her first solo album. She's left Sunny, and she's come to Muscle Shoals to record. Well, it was a flopper, as
it
they
was
say.
A flop. But you said she left Sunny, meaning as a duo.
Yes.
They were still married.
Yes.
And he showed up.
That was a funny
story. They actually
told
the story that he was there. And just do the tour. I'll let them share that story.
But. Do the tour. Okay. So even though you've got Cher, it doesn't mean that you've got a hit, unfortunately.
Well, one of the things I thought was fascinating, too, was her album was called their address of the building.
Yes.
And I just 3614 Jackson Highway was the name of the album.
Yes.
And the way it's printed on the album, the building actually was just stone and didn't have anything on the front of it.
Right.
It said Muscle Shoals Sound Studio on the side.
Right.
So they actually copied. They liked how it looked with the address across the building on her album. So now they put that on the building and it's on there.
Yeah.
I just thought that was funny.
You would think, because the picture of her album is her and her band standing out in front of the building, you would think that, yeah, that the picture is just them under the sign. Well, the sign, like you said, didn't exist.
Right.
So that's so cool that they thought they liked the look of the album so much at the studio. They were like, oh, we should make that how our sign looks.
And actually, the album, it has everybody that was there. It has the Swampers. It has Jerry Wexler. It has Sonny Bono.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're all in the picture.
Yeah.
So, that's
probably one of the most iconic photos.
Since it's a flop of an album. I just think that's all funny.
It's true. Well, then they start working with a guy named R.B. Greaves, which, you know, our tour guide was so fun. He was like, anybody know that name? Which nobody did. And Then he played the song, Take a Letter, Maria, which we all knew and started singing. So sometimes you just don't know artist
one
names.
Hit wonders,
so
one hit know. Wonders.
So let's talk about that week, though, that they started working with R.B. Greaves, because they were also busy in the evenings with a little band called the Rolling Stones. Now, the Rolling Stones had played Auburn University's stadium.
Yeah.
And so they were on tour, but they had 3 nights in between stops. And so they spent it there in Muscle Shoals. Kept it under the radar. Nobody knew that's what they were doing. Came in via helicopter, right?
Yeah. So I asked the question, you guys may be wondering this as well. What does it look like for these? I know when we made our trip from Nashville, it was 2.5 hour drive south for us. But I said, what does this look like for an artist to come in to Muscle Shoals? Did they fly into Muscle Shoals?
Right.
Like, did they, you know, fly into Huntsville? And they said they typically flew into Huntsville or Nashville.
Yeah.
If they flew into Huntsville, I think it's about 1 hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
They would drive west to get to Muscle Shoals.
Okay.
For the Stones, however, it's the Stones. They're already big.
Right. So yeah, they were playing stadiums.
Yeah. So they have flown in on a very large private jet into Huntsville and then helicoptered to Muscle Shoals.
Yeah.
Airport.
Yeah.
Muscle Shoals does have an airport, but pretty small. So anyhow, and they had a couple pictures of them in the airport.
Yeah. So Jerry Wexler brings them over to the studio. I mean, who knows what they were saying? I could only imagine Keith Richards, right? On this back roads of Alabama going, where are we going?
What is happening? Yeah.
And they get there, love the vibe. They love the vibe. And they ended up cutting 3 songs from their 1971 album that was called Sticky Fingers. Brown Sugar.
Little song called Brown Sugar.
You Gotta Move. And Wild Horses.
And Wild Horses, Keith Richards actually wrote... Finished writing in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And you know what I started thinking? Because I started thinking, that place is so small. I bet just to have a focus, you would have to go in the bathroom.
That's true.
I don't think it's because he wanted, like, he was just doing his business.
Right.
I bet he's like, I need to shut the door, and this is the only door.
That is so true, Lainey. That is so true. And probably same for the maracas. They had a picture of Mick Jagger playing the maracas, which come in at the end of Brown Sugar. I mean, these are just moments where you're like, I can't believe I'm standing.
Where this happened.
Where that moment happened.
It's so epic.
I just can't believe it.
Yeah, he was basically in a closet shaking the maracas, right? Isn't that where they showed a picture?
Yeah, yeah.
And the sound guy gets real close to him to capture it.
To capture it, yeah. So... Unfortunately for the studio, they did not get credit for those songs being recorded there.
I thought this was fascinating.
The Stones didn't have working visas. They were allowed to tour and perform, but a working visa, I guess, is different enough that they were not able to credit the studio on the album because they didn't have visas to say that they've been doing
it. It is fascinating because they have the bill that they...
Yeah.
You know, where it's
They've
written
got
out.
Lots to prove it happened there.
They have pictures. And now the guys say that that's where they did it. I mean, they're not saying that they didn't record it there.
Right. No, they're all in the documentary going on and on.
Going on and on about that it's rock and roll heaven down there.
Yes. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I think it's so interesting to think about the way that music, you know, it really can be created in lots of places now and people's basements and, you know, cottage out back or, you know, like just home studios.
Yep.
That was just not the case, though, at that time. And so this was like going to someone's living room.
That had good players.
That had good players.
That had good.
Yeah.
Just good mojo.
Yes. Yes. I think mojo was cited. Yes. So, during the time period of 1969 to 1978, the Swampers, they played on over 200 albums.
And they have a lot of those albums there. Some of them signed.
They had 70...
In the lounge.
Yeah, they had 75 gold and platinum records, hundreds of hit songs with artists like Lynyrd Skynyrd, Bob Dylan, Duane Allman, Paul Simon, Art Garfunkel, Bob Seger, Staple Singers, Rod Stewart, Leon Russell, Willie Nelson, Cat Stevens. I mean, it goes on actually goes and on. I'm just going to stop.
And they would, I loved in the tour when they would play us clips of songs that I literally have played in my car in the last 6 months.
Uh-huh.
That you're just like, that happened right here.
Yeah.
Kodachrome.
Yeah.
By Paul Simon. They have this Yamaha piano.
Yeah.
That was the piano on any of these albums that were mentioned. But Bob Seger's, you know, the infamous Tom Cruise slide-in piano.
Oh, yeah. That is that moment. Rock and roll.
Yes.
Yeah.
So fun. It happened right there.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, just one room that you're just like, over here, and they've got great... It's set up so awesome. You know, they've got this marked over here. This happened. You get the photograph to just go over to the corner to appreciate that. And I actually saw that Paul Simon, I think he had like 3 days booked there because he was used to studio time taking
forever.
That long. And he only had like one song he intended to do. So Kodachrome and... what was the other one? Still Crazy? Yeah, Still Crazy After All These Years. Those just came because they finished the first song that he came to do so fast. He was like, well
then we'll
I've already paid
these.
For 2 more days.
I love it.
Do y'all want to work on some more? Isn't that crazy? That's they were so, that good.
That's so cool.
So fast, so gifted. That's just so cool to think
it
about.
It really is. Oh, and I loved the story where... which album was it where... Oh, it was a Mavis Staples. It was a Staples album.
Good, yeah.
Where she's calling David Hood Little David and Louder David or something. Like, she's calling him by name.
And it was that song, that album, that Paul Simon had heard that is the reason why he wanted to go play with those players.
Okay.
And he actually called...
I missed that.
He called Stax Records. Paul Simon's...
Oh, yes.
Paul Simon's manager or somebody from his team calls Stax Records in Memphis and
because
says,
that's where the Staples had been doing a lot of stuff.
You guys work with the Staples, you know, singers. I want that Jamaican black band that is on... I'll take you there. And
they're he's a little paler than that. These guys are paler.
Mighty pale compared to that. Yeah, which, you know... Again, so cool that they were all working together and making such...
Even some white guys got good rhythm.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is also still an active studio today for recording. And you can, of course, tour it. But if you are a musician and want to book time, you can do that.
At Fame or Muscle Shoals Sound.
Yes. Yes. So, highly recommend the tours. We had such an incredible experience. I mean, I'm sorry, still just like thinking about being at that sound studio and that the demo for Freebird was done here and Simple Man and Give Me 3 Steps. And I mean, it was on and on. Now, those were the demos. Unfortunately, there was a whole big story about it wasn't the actual recording that we
that
hear
we all
today.
Know.
But still, just the genesis of those songs.
And those people.
Oh,
and
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the fact that you could have been living there and had no clue that these people were in town blows my mind.
Blows my mind.
And they wanted to keep it that way. They wanted it under wraps.
Yeah, they were supposed to keep it to themselves, who they were working with. And yeah. And they did. They were secret keepers.
That's really wild.
So we would like to close out this episode and honor the man that really did start this sort of music incubator, if you will, in Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall, since he passed away in 2018. Obviously, we did not get time with him during his life, but we got to talk to his wife, Linda, of they were married 58 years, and she was just a gem.
She really was.
You know, she originally thought that she was going to marry a Baptist deacon and be a church pianist. And she had different plans before she met Rick that she thought her life was set towards. And that all changed when she met Rick Hall, who, of course, like we said later, went on to found Fame. And they have 3 boys together. she was so busy really being a mom and a wife in the 60s and 70s that, you know, when a lot of this was happening, she wasn't necessarily in the studios. In fact, Rick preferred her not to be in the studios. He wanted to keep work and life, home life, that. And she did start working there in 1979 to keep the books, which is what she still does today.
And she chose herself not to be literally in the studio after that.
Yes.
She said, I didn't want to hear the language I would be hearing in there and the arguments and all of that she knew Rick may be ensuing and engaged in there. So she stayed out of the studio until he passed away.
Yes, that is so true.
That's
yes.
wild to think about, too, because if all those things were happening, all that magic was happening on the other side of the wall, it would be really hard not to be in there.
I know. But when Steven Tyler came by, he said, what do you mean you've never been in a recording session? This was in 2018, just after, maybe 2 months after Rick had passed.
Yep.
So he took her by the hand and said, well, you're going to sit in on this one. So it
sounds
just
like they had some tender moments together.
Yeah. We want to close out this episode with our conversation with her. And, you know, she did talk about to us just how much the documentary has made an incredible impact on the whole community. And, you know, that there were in 2013 when the documentary came out, that there were 3 struggling studios. And that now, since the documentary, that there are 13
active
studios. I mean, really, it's wild. Just amazing the impact that documentary made. So,
if you want to make this a trip, Florence is a very happening little downtown.
It sure is.
Lots of shops and restaurants. There's an old hotel called the Gunrunner that has a restaurant and I think even a spa that you could stay at. There's other locations where you can stay as well, little boutique hotels and things.
Helen Keller's from this area. If you would like to tour where she grew up, that's even an available option of something to go see. It's kind of interesting that all these little happenings were so close to one another. So yeah, the downtown area was super cute.
I wish we'd had a little more time
to drive around there.
But
did you mention the fashion designer Billy
Reed? I did not. Billy Reed is from Florence, Alabama. I'm assuming that's his flagship store, but I don't know that for sure. But he does have a store there, and
yeah,
there's lots to see in Florence.
So much to see. So, final word to the matriarch herself, Linda Hall. We just can't wait for you guys to meet her, and we'll see you back here next time.
Let's just kick off with kind of start with where this all started.
Where it all started. It started with a man so determined to be somebody that nobody could stop him.
Okay.
Or nothing could stop him except the Lord. And he was raised very poor. Have you watched the documentary?
Okay. I have.
So he was raised very, very poor. I tell everybody that it took him 45 years to get from the dirt floor sawmill shack to that 10,000 square foot house. But he made it. Mm-hmm. He was just so driven by all of his hardships and everything that happened to him while he was in a younger life. Mm-hmm. And he swore up and down he'd never marry again after his first wife was killed until he saw me. But I never knew a person that worked as hard as Rick did.
Okay. So that leads me to one of the questions I wanted to ask you. What was it about Rick that was so special that would cause this to be birthed?
Well, he was so driven, and as he said over and over in the documentary, he just wanted to be somebody, because he always felt like growing up that he couldn't date the girls that had money. He couldn't date the, you know, and he was always considered the kid from the wrong side of the tracks. He was poor. He wasn't anybody in his eyes, and he just wanted to prove a point. And then after we married, I felt like, because all of my friends, most of them deserted me when I married Rick. And they thought I'd married this long-haired hippie that was, you know, poor white trash. And he had a point to prove to them. Wow. He had a point to prove to me, and he had a point to prove to his family, because his sister kept telling him, why don't you just quit and get a regular job? Why don't you go back to work at Reynolds and, you know, do your thing that way? And quit having all these kids. You're not going to be just like Daddy was, not be able to support them, and da-da-da-da-da. And it just hurt our feelings so bad, and hurt him. And I think that just drove him harder to, I'll show you. I'll just show you.
Yeah.
He did. He was a perfectionist. He wanted everything to be. He wanted you to do the very best you could. And he pushed you till you thought, I can't take it anymore. But, and he did me. He did our boys that way. He did everybody that way. I mean, you know, the musicians didn't get any treatment that we didn't get. And I'm so thankful for that today, because it made me a stronger person. It made me work harder at achieving goals and doing things the right way. You know, and I've tried to teach these younger guys that we have working here now, try to instill that in them. It's a lot harder for me to instill it in them than it was him, but because I hadn't accomplished what he accomplished.
Yeah, but what did the day-to-day feel of Fame Studios feel like?
It was a struggle. It was hard. The reason I came to work is was in financial trouble. We had built the big house. We'd overspent on that. He had gotten sick and had quit working as much. And then when he came back to work, all of his peers had left the record labels. Nobody wanted to let him produce a record. So we were struggling.
Wow.
And so I came to work, and I wondered, you know, a lot of days, how are we going to pay the bills? And at the same time I came to work, when I first came to work, I found out our secretary had been embezzling from us. So on top of everything else being tough, she was stealing her money. So we had a bond on her, and our employees was bonded at that time. And so Rick told me, he said, I'm going to give you the privilege of letting her go. I said, well, gee, thanks. So I just told her we couldn't afford her anymore and let her go. I didn't confront her with it. I just turned it over to the bond company and let them do it, because we really liked her. We really loved her, you know, and it just broke our heart.
That's really hurtful.
But she was forging his name on checks and just taking them home with her. But anyway, so we got through that, and at that point we started concentrating more on our publishing companies and doing that. And he had always told me, even when the boys was little, before I ever even knew anything about the business, that if anything ever happens to me, don't get rid of the publishing companies, because that will be something that would support you and the kids. And so that was the reason I came to work, was to learn about the publishing companies. And I'm so thankful now.
And he was right.
That I did. And that I did know a little bit about it, that when he passed on, that it wasn't just like I was jumping into something and I didn't know what I was doing at all. But I do want to say this. All those years that we were married, I never quit praying for him. I never stopped. I never quit going to church. He didn't always go with me. Sometimes he would go, sometimes he wouldn't. But as time went on, after the boys got grown, had grandkids, he started going to church with me. And he got to where he'd even go to Sunday school, which, you know, I never thought I'd see that day. But then he was saved about 3 years before he passed
praise
away.
Praise the Lord. Wow.
And every bit of it was all worth it. And I thought, I never thought I'd ever live to see the day.
Wow.
But I was so happy. That was that was the happiest day of my life. And up until then, it had been the day I married him. But he was such a changed man. He was so different. And so many people could see it. I mean, the people that had worked with him, the people that had been around him a lot, they could tell the difference. They knew there was a real difference there. And it's just been, you know, it's been much, much easier to be able to give him up.
Oh, for
after
sure.
After he was saved. Because it was,
because you know that wasn't the last you'll see of him.
I know it wasn't.
You've just listened to an episode of the Steel Magnolias podcast, an independent show funded solely on support from listeners like you and a few advertisers from time to time. For reminders of what we just said and links to what we just mentioned, take a look at the description of this episode. They are right there. Are you enjoying the show? We hope you'll text a friend or a loved one to tell them about the podcast. Make sure they know how to get to a podcast first. And we invite you to join our mailing list to be the first to know about episodes, giveaways, events, and even those gatherings. Sign up at steelmagnoliaspodcast.com.
When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work across 500,000 apps and websites so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context. Plus, tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly, easier said, done.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.